most trusted and longest-running sports talk show in Tennessee. From the Budweiser studios of Cumulus Broadcasting, this is Sports Talk with John Wilkerson and Jimmy Hines on Sports Radio WNML.
For Sports Talk with Jimmy Hyams, I'm John Wilkerson. A lot coming your way before we step aside, and we lead into the starting 11 with Will West, followed by In the Cage with Vince Ferrara. So we go on all the way up until 9 o'clock with our local programming today on 99.1 The Sports Animal. We look forward to catching up with ESPN senior writer Ryan McGee. That'll be a little bit later this hour. We'll also talk more and hear stories about Hank Aaron when he hit home run number 715. But right now, we have your chance to showcase your mad trivia skills. A golden attaboy hangs in the balance along with an audio reward. Jimmy, what is today's Sports Fix It 6 question?
It was 46 years ago. Hank Aaron hit home run number 715. There was an Atlanta Brave on base, and there was a Brave in the on-deck circle. Name either one of them. Name the Atlanta player that was on base when Hank Aaron hit the home run, or the batter that was on deck.
656-9900, 656-9900, star 990 is free for AT&T and U.S. Cellular customers. The toll-free number, 1-866-656-9900. Let's go to Danny. Hello, Danny.
Hey, John. How you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
Pretty good. How you doing, Jimmy?
Hey, Danny, doing great. Hope you are, too.
Yeah, I reckon. One man on base or batting, right?
One man on base, yeah. One man on deck. Name either one for the Braves.
I believe it's Barry Bonds.
Not Bonds.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Danny, we sure do appreciate it. Let's go to Fred. Hello, Fred.
I think Chipper came later, but I'll say Chipper.
Not Chipper. He did come later.
But, Fred, good to hear from you. Sure hope you're doing well. Tommy is up next. Hello, Tommy.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
I don't know who was on base, but Dusty Baker was in the on-deck circle.
Well, there you go. You are correct. Dusty Baker was on the on-deck circle when Hank Aaron hit number 715. Darrell Evans was on base when Aaron hit that home run. Hey, Tommy, good job. Dusty Baker is correct. We were looking for one or the other. You got it. So congratulations, Tommy.
Thank you, guys.
Well done, Tommy.
Good to talk to you guys.
Good to talk to you. Hope all is well in your world. So hang on the line as you have won today's golden attaboy. And now you here are your just desserts, your audio reward.
This is the greatest night in the history of my life. I just want to say one thing. Yo, Adrian! Adrian!
Glory. Last forever.
It's pretty. It's so pretty.
Go with Sizzler. We go with Sizzler.
What you gonna do, Jerry?
Show me the money!
It looks like I'm a wreck. It's in the hole! It's in the hole!
Again, we celebrate Tommy with his correct answer to tonight's trivia question, the Sports Fix at 6, and we'll have another challenge for you tomorrow night. And, Jimmy, as we've caught up today with Kim Mulkey, another member of this incredible class that's going into the Basketball Hall of Fame, is the first player of Pat Summitt to go into the Hall as a player in Tamika Catchings.
And what a fantastic player she was. She had a media avail recently, and she was asked what she thought of her legacy.
You've accomplished everything that could be accomplished, you know, in your career. Have you begun thinking about your legacy and what you like the history books to say about the kind of life you lived and the impact you left?
I think the biggest thing is just how relentless I was in every aspect of life. And the same way that I am on the court is the same way that I am off the court. The passion, the love, just having fun and being genuine. You know, I think that's probably the biggest thing for me is in everything that I do, I go 100%. And if I know I can't go 100%, more than likely I'm not going to do it until I can give 100%. So, you know, I think my legacy is really around the impact that I've made on and off the court, the younger players that have been there, and even some of the older ones that I've had the opportunity to play with. You know, I'm getting a lot of notes and texts from former teammates and then just other players that I play with overseas and then players that are, you know, still playing that I played against and just, it's just been awesome. You know, I think my legacy now from the front office standpoint is building team and building players and not just on the court, because obviously, you know, we have the coaching staff for that. But I think really trying to help our players while they're playing figure out, you know, the roadmap to life, because it's not easy making a transition. I think everybody looks at me and it's like, oh, you know, that's Tamika, and she was able to make the transition to the front office and beyond. But it was, there's still some days, your ups and downs. And so really for our players while they're playing, trying to make sure that they have everything that they need to help them succeed.
Hi, Tamika. Congratulations. This is awesome, obviously. You know, there's a lot of what ifs in any career, certainly. But, I mean, you're old enough where you can remember, I think anyway, you're old enough to remember a time where there wasn't the WNBA. How did that league really put you in a position, you think, where here you are, all of a sudden you're in the Hall of Fame?
Wow. Well, seventh grade, I made the goal that I was going to be in the NBA. And that's what, like everything, every day that I went out, every single thing that I did, I was focused on that. And the WNBA came, of course, 96 Olympics happened, and the WNBA came right after that. And I just remember, first, my goal was to be an Olympian. And then when the W came, I was like, man, like, this league was made just for us, for players, for people like us. Female empowerment, women's empowerment, like all about it, right? Having the opportunity to watch it, I did an internship in between my junior and senior year at Tennessee. I was actually an intern for the Phoenix Mercury. So I spent some time out there and just saw the All-Star game was there that year. And I was just like, oh my God, like in heaven, WNBA heaven. And then of course I got drafted, I got hurt, and then I got drafted here in Indiana. But, you know, I think when I look back at my career, I'm so thankful. First off, just thankful for the opportunity for this little girl to have her dream made, and thankful for the Simon for believing in, you know, bringing a WNBA team to Indiana and the Pacers organization and putting it underneath that umbrella, because I don't know where I would be. Seattle had number one. They got Lauren Jackson. Charlotte got number two. They got Kelly Miller. And what if I would have went one or two and not ended up here? So I think sometimes I look at that, but, you know, having the opportunity and looking at my career and looking back at it and just all the opportunities. But, you know, I'm also thankful for the community here, because literally when my sister and I came and dropped foot in Indy, like people just came and like put their arms around us, and we've been protected by not just the organization, but our community. And that's a huge reason why I'm still here.
Comments from Tamika Catchings, the former Lady Vol great, selected for the Basketball Hall of Fame.
When we return, we look forward to catching up with ESPN senior writer Ryan McGee. That's next as you listen to 99.1, The Sports Animal.
To take the latest on Tennessee sports coverage with you anywhere you go, download the Sports Radio WNML app. Powered by Big Kahuna Wings, the wings that changed it all.
Sports Talk continues with Jimmy Hyams. I'm John Wilkerson. We head to the Stanley Fence and Gates hotline, and it is an absolute pleasure to say hello to Ryan McGee, senior writer for ESPN. You, of course, see him all the time on television. You've followed his work for years. He was outstanding as a big-time contributor for Saturdays in the South last fall when we saw that incredible documentary, and he joins us now. Ryan, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I appreciate the kind words. And, yeah, I mean, Jimmy knows this. My wife told me, she goes, I know you were so excited when we were watching Saturdays in the South. And she said, why? And she said, all of that useless knowledge that you had about how Bobby Dodd used to run practice. She goes, in the 17 times that you read the General Nealon book, she goes, you finally have an opportunity to use that. And I go, you're right. I just wanted to make it to the 150th anniversary.
That's wonderful. What was it like to be a big part of helping introduce General Nealon and everything that went into his impact on the conference, on the sport of college football, to a whole new audience?
Well, honestly, and you guys know this, General Nealon is an underappreciated character in the history of college football, and it's just because of when he made his living. You know, if he coached 15 years later, everybody would know more about him because there'd be an entire library of television games, and that just doesn't exist. And so, you know, when I was a student at Tennessee, I think it was my junior year, sophomore year, was the big 100th anniversary of Tennessee football. And, you know, I was just really fortunate. I had a job in the athletic department, and, you know, we were just sitting there watching film of the single wing over and over and over again. And I'm a guy that grew up in the Carolinas, and so I knew a lot about Johnny Majors, and I knew even more about Reggie White and Willie Gault. I didn't know anything about General Nealon except his name was on the stadium. And so I just kind of immersed myself in that as a student. And again, I've had this knowledge that I've been carrying around forever. And, you know, you don't understand how excited I was. You know, all that stuff, all that history stuff. Ivan Mazel made so much fun of me. Cause I was like, you don't understand. I finally get to tell the story of the checkerboard end zones. I said, no one's ever actually asked, you know. They just go, those are cool. And so, I mean, so it's just, it was an opportunity to nerd out on a level that I never thought I'd get to do on Tennessee football.
Ryan, I, like you, love college football. I thought that series was so well done. It was so much fun to watch. I learned a tremendous amount about the background of the SEC. And I just wondered if you had as much fun watching it, the final product, as you had being involved with it.
I did, and it's funny because the directors of the film had a really unorthodox interviewing style. And so, you know, I went into the interview knowing they were going to ask me questions about certain things, particularly when it came to Tennessee. And the interviews took these kind of weird, you know, just strange roads to get to the topics that we were actually supposed to talk about. And I used to be a producer. And so in my mind the whole time I'm doing the math, I'm like, man, when are you going to ask me about Johnny Majors? Because, you know, we've been talking about somebody I've never heard of for an hour and a half, you know. I only got so much, you know, George Gaffico stories. I got to get to somebody I actually, you know, knew or saw or whatever. And so it was interesting sitting and watching how it all came together and all the voices in it. And the stories that were told, and it just was about, I felt they did a tremendous job. And so, yeah, we, you know, I joke about Ivan Mazel, but that whole project, Saturdays in the South, and America's Game, and our roundtable shows, all of that CFB 150 stuff, you guys know Ivan. He'd been working on that for years. And so to see it all come together across so many platforms and so many people get behind it, it was really something to watch.
I don't know how much you learned. I learned a lot. Of course, I knew about Bo Jackson, Herschel Walker, and all that. Ron, the thing that I did not realize was how many great coaches in the SEC served our country. Did you know that? Other than Nealon, of course.
Sure, but I kind of thought that was it. You know, I wasn't aware, like, you know, I mean, we all know Bear Bryant's story. But, you know, I didn't know the story about, you know, the Bear was on his way to interview for a job and Pearl Harbor happened. Mm-hmm. And he turns the car around and signs up. And there were so many of those stories, and I just didn't know. You know, and again, you know, my grandfather, I'm standing in my office in Charlotte right now, and I'm looking at this picture of my grandfather, Marshall Cadell from Rockingham, North Carolina, and the ship that he was blown off of by a kamikaze, you know, plane when he was 19 years old in the Pacific. He never talked about it. And, you know, guys like Bear Bryant and you know, they just came back and did their job. And if somebody asked them about it, great. But they weren't going to volunteer those stories. And so, yeah, I learned so much. And just about the evolution of the game. You know, you think about, you know, my dad, you guys know this, my dad was a college football official for 40 years. And we talk all the time about when he started in Division I football in 1981. And, you know, you might see a couple of field goal attempts in a month. And, you know, certainly nobody's going deep. And then when he retired, his last game was the 09 BCS championship game, and it was Sam Bradford and Tim Tebow. I mean, that's how much the game evolved. And so to go a whole century past that and see how the game started and where it is now is just there's just so – and so many things could have gone wrong, right? I mean, they could have shut the sport down if Teddy Roosevelt doesn't save it. And we're not having any conversation about any of this. And so – the evolution of the whole thing just completely, the depth of it completely caught me off guard.
This is usually such a very busy time. You would have spring games that were wrapping up, spring practice, and, of course, baseball underway, so many different things, but everything is on hold, and we sure hope that it's much sooner rather than later that we get back to heading in the direction of normality. But what has it been like from your vantage point, Ryan, to just see the sports world on hold as it is?
You know, it's funny. My daily routine hasn't changed a whole lot. I always joke that I'm Raymond from Everybody Loves Raymond. I work out of the basement. I've had for a long time. You know, the difference is right now upstairs, my daughter's at school. You know, she's doing her homework, and it's not homework. It's actual schoolwork. And so those things have changed. But, like, ESPN just showed the 86 Masters. And kind of watching Twitter going, oh, my gosh, can Jack Nicklaus pull this off again? And, you know, last night I watched Cal Ripken's, you know, record-breaking game where he broke Lou Gehrig's streak. And so we're consuming it differently. We're still talking about football. You know, the NFL draft, whatever form it's going to be, I'm still getting the calls like I always do around the 1st of April from the NFL people who don't ever watch any college football. And now they want to know, what's this guy like and what's that guy like? And so so those things haven't changed, but there's just kind of this you know, specter in the background that we're all dealing with, and it's not just us. I mean, I was texting with an ESPN coworker in London this morning, and it's the same thing over there. I mean, no matter where you are in the world. And so it's just the uncertainty of, we all know that we're going to walk out the door one day and go to a game. We just don't know when that's going to be, and that's the part that the conversations are still happening about, you know, what's the quarterback play going to be like at Tennessee this year? Or, you know, has Nick Saban lost the handle? Or can LSU get it back together? All those conversations are still happening. We just don't know when we're actually going to get the answers to those questions because we don't know when we're going to play football.
Should we be thankful that it's not Mike Gundy's call?
Oh, man. Yeah. And you saw the Oklahoma State, they did not support him on that. And there was and there have been a lot of guys. Greg Sankey today, as he will do, he was on Paul Feinbaum earlier today, and he was very measured about, like, listen, we don't know what we're dealing with. We're all hoping for the best. But, you know, what he said, wherever the virus takes us is where we're going to go. And I think my comment on Twitter was that somewhere Mike Gundy is washing his mullet in his sink and listening to that and not agreeing with it.
Ryan, Mac Brown said we can't have football if we don't have fans. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. I think that because I think the fans are at home. You know, the reality is that – so you guys know I cover motorsports. And NASCAR and IndyCar are running they're running video game races. It's called iRacing. And, you know, it's all the same drivers that would have run at Bristol last weekend, and instead they were all in their, you know, their simulators in their houses that they all have, you know, and it was televised by Fox, and a million people watched. And that's about the number of people that are watching some NASCAR races, real races. And so, you know, last night ESPN had a lot of people watching, you know, Cal Ripken's record-breaking game, and I'm sure in the middle of the afternoon on a Wednesday, a lot of people were watching the 86 Masters. So I think that the consumption of the sport, and this is why I have not railed on Major League Baseball for investigating this idea of playing games in Arizona in front of no one in spring training facilities. You know, people are going to watch on television. I can tell you that. because right now they're watching anything that's interesting. Mm-hmm. What kind of world are we living in where the Tiger King is the most popular man in America, right, on Netflix? Just because people are dying for something to watch. And so if the CDC says these kids can play ball, but we don't need 80,000 people rubbing shoulders around them, then you know, I'm not going to argue with them. But if that's the best we can do when we get there, and I hope that it's not, that's still pretty good, and it's still something that everybody can watch on Saturday. So I would think about it before I ripped it.
Yeah, I watched the Tiger King the other day, and I thought it was something about Auburn. I got mad when it wasn't Auburn football.
the least shocking thing about the Tiger King is that at some point that story ran through Myrtle Beach. I looked at my wife and I go, I don't know how I knew this was going to get to Myrtle Beach, but it got there. The only surprising part was it didn't run through Pigeon Forge at some point. I figured it would, but maybe in the sequel.
Did you ever think you would hear this sentence? National Coach of the Year, Ed Orgeron.
No, not a chance. But, you know, what a story, though. I mean, you know, this is a guy who got in a lot of trouble and maybe should have gotten into a lot more trouble than he actually did when he was an assistant coach in Miami. I mean, basically tried to kill himself with the partying. He hasn't had a drink in forever because of what he did back then. And we all saw what he did at Ole Miss. And he always has talked about, you know, that was a learning experience. But the guy I saw at Ole Miss and the guy I saw as the interim coach at USC, I thought that, all right, you know what, he's going to be a great coordinator for the rest of his career. And I was at the LSU-Alabama game when he took over as interim coach, and LSU did not win the game, and he still received a standing ovation as he left the field that night. And then they hired him, and I'm thinking, all right, well, this is an emotional hire. And I like Ed a lot. But what he did and what he has transformed into as a person versus what he was, and yes, I understand there's marital problems and all that stuff, but you look at where he was in his life 25 years ago, 10 years ago, and look at where he is now, not just as a coach, but just as a person. It's he owns it. That's the other part, is he owns it. And so no way in the world I would have thought that. But he did it, and he earned it, because that was one of the best football teams I've ever seen.
Ryan, we really appreciate the time, and also really appreciate how you bring so many smiles to so many people's faces, you and Marty, with Marty and McGee. Obviously, these are serious times, but at the same time, you give people a chance to, if they follow you on Twitter, which is a fantastic follow, at ESPN McGee, just for instance, just to see what was under the storage in your RAM yesterday, just to see one thing after another. But really appreciate your positivity and all that you bring to light.
Hey, it's always great to talk to you guys. And you know, I married a Farragut girl, so somewhere my in-laws are listening. So, hey, y'all.
Well, we sure do appreciate it. Stay well, be safe, and we look forward to catching up with you again in the future.
Call me anytime, guys. Thanks.
All right, thank you. That's senior writer Ryan McGee at ESPN. We'll get a break. When we return, we've got more coming your way as you listen to Sports Talk on 99.1 The Sports Animal.
Name a more iconic duo than the Budweiser Studios and Cumulus Broadcasting.
It's all right.
I'll wait. This is Sports Radio WNML.
Sports Talk continues with Jimmy Hyams. I'm John Wilkerson, as we've talked about with a couple of folks that have been on with us today, as well as what was our Sports Fix at 6. Jimmy, do you remember where you were when Hank Aaron hit number 715?
Absolutely. I was watching the Braves game, and I was getting a little bit nervous because I was supposed to leave to go play a basketball game that night with a group of people we had set up. And I'm like, I'm not leaving until this at-bat's over. I've got to see this. And then he hit a home run. But I remember exactly what I was doing in my thought process about, I don't want to leave. I got to see this. This is historic. So, yes, I do remember.
It was 6 years ago when it was the 40th anniversary that I was very fortunate to catch up with a number of people. Talked with Tom House, who was the Braves relief pitcher who caught the home run in the bullpen. Was able to talk with Rusty Enzer as the VFL shared his memories. Condridge Holloway was also pleased at the time, and he has since passed, to talk with Craig Sager. Sager, of course, known far and wide for all the work and the wild shoes and sport coats and suits that he wore when covering the NBA. But if you look at those pictures of the Braves gathering around home plate as Hank Aaron made that trip complete with his 715th home run, you see a guy wearing a raincoat, and that's Craig Sager. He had just graduated from Northwestern. He had made his way up to Atlanta to cover that as he was working in Florida. But it was 6 years ago that I caught up with Craig Sager, and he was kind enough to share his memories of this momentous event. So here is my conversation with the late Craig Sager.
What's it been like to be a part of the story, as I know you've already been asked a lot of times about the 40th anniversary?
Well, you know, obviously it was a tremendous, tremendous moment in my life to be there. And at the time, you know, I knew it was a historic moment, and I knew the significance it had on the record books. And I also knew how passionate I was about baseball and how much I idolized Hank growing up, so as a personal basis as well. And, you know, I obviously went up there on my own because my radio station in Sarasota, Florida, WSBB, where I was getting paid $95 a week, wasn't about to send me there. In fact, they said if I wasn't back by morning drive the next day, I'd be fired. But I caught a 5 a.m. flight, I think, on National Airlines, which is out of business now, and I made it back. And then my general manager got me on the air and said, oh, we made a great decision by sending you. And they act like it was his idea. But I did keep my job. And it was just one of those moments that, you know, I hate to think that my career peaked at the age of 22. But it's hard to – I've covered probably 8 Olympic games, and I've done NBA games everywhere and done every other sport. But certainly they all pale in comparison to that moment being there for the 715th home run 40 years ago today.
Well, and just to think about all the hoops that you have to jump through today to get credentials and things like that, did you have any trouble getting into the game as a media representative?
Well, you got to remember, there wasn't as much media as there is now. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have any ESPN, there weren't any cable networks. You didn't have all those outlets. And the fact that it was bad weather and all, WSBV was one of those radio stations that carried baseball games on radio, and so we were part of the network for the Braves, and so we had some of their games, so there's a contact I had made through spring training, and so I called up, and I said, can I get a credential? And I said, well, yeah, we'll give you a credential, but you won't have a seat. And I said, okay, I don't care, I just want to be there. And so the bad weather, the cool weather, the press box was full with the print media, and then all the photographers and all, we lined up on the first base side by the camera well there, so they could get the swing, because obviously Hank being a right-handed batter, and they'd also wanted to follow the flight of the ball. So I was over on third base all by myself over there with my trench coat, my tape recorder, calling my own play-by-play. That's what I wanted to do someday, was call baseball games, and I was trying to get a resume tape, and when he hit it, I just instinctively ran out to home plate. And so that 20 minutes that they took between the home run and stopping the game, and then having Hank, you know, with the ceremony and the acknowledgement, I was doing interviews with all his teammates and with his mom and, you know, different players and Al Downing even, and the stuff I have with his mom is so precious, you know. And I knew he'd do it. I knew he'd do it. And she's screaming and hollering, and it's precious audio that I later played for Hank, and then we tried to give it to the Hall of Fame. So they show the home run, and then when the home run ends, they go to my audio with all the interviews, and it's played continuously on a loop in Cooperstown, and they give me a lifetime pass to the Hall of Fame. So I never made my goal of being a professional baseball player, but somehow I got my way into the back door of the Hall of Fame.
Now, there was so much pomp and circumstance. This was the Braves' home opener, and he had hit number 714 in Cincinnati. So NBC's making this a Monday Night Baseball broadcast. What was it like to be a part of that atmosphere, as it was a rare sellout for Fulton County Stadium?
Back then, you're talking about, you know, the 73 to 74 season, you know, the NBA wasn't even televised, and football didn't have as much following as it does now, and everything, you know, baseball was definitely America's pastime, and all winter long, you had all the talk about he's one away from tying it, you know, two from breaking it. It was just, the buildup was so immense, and then when he hit the one in Cincinnati that tied it, had even more of a buildup. And it was one of those things that games weren't televised. You know, there's a Saturday afternoon baseball game, maybe, and that was about it. And when they decided to televise this nationwide, and you just had the feeling that Hank wanted to get this over with, and he just was primed. And like I said, when I went up there, the weather was kind of iffy, and there's some thoughts about maybe even not playing it that night, but you couldn't because of the network television. And it was just everything finally came together. And then, you know, obviously he hit the fourth inning, which was a relief to everybody, including Hank. But it was spectacular. And, you know, it's played more now than it ever has been because of the cable outlets and the video and the YouTubes and everything else that we didn't have back then.
What was it like in that first inning when he draws a walk? Everybody's waiting for that home run, and then it was a walk, and then so people had to wait a little bit longer.
Yeah, it was one of those. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, my God, if he doesn't hit it tonight, I got to be back by drive time tomorrow. I lose my job, and I can't come back again the next day. Come on, Hank. So, you got to do it, buddy. And so I was really rooting for him, and I was so excited that, you know, that's why I said I just ran out onto the field. And they're having a little ceremony tonight in Atlanta where they're going to recreate it. I'm in Miami doing the Heat Nets game, so I'm going to miss it, but they did invite me back. But a lot of the special guests, a lot of people who are there that night are going to be there. And there's also a famous person who threw a pitch. I'm not supposed to relieve what's happening or because it's supposed to be a surprise, but that certain somebody may be throwing out the first pitch tonight, so it could be a special event.
Okay. Just from a broadcast point of view, what kind of recorder did you have with you to record this incredible moment in baseball and American history?
Just one of those tape recorders with a cassette in it that I used as news director in Sarasota. And it had like a 30-minute tape in it, and then you'd obviously replay it. But I did the audio with the home run and all the different interviews afterwards, and I dubbed it over to a 2-inch tape, which we have video-wise, and I matched the home run with my call of it. So, you know, you got all these other people, Milo Hamilton doing his call and everything else, but I have my own where I call the home run.
Well, I'm just impressed at how proactive you were, being 22 years old. Obviously it was with the threat of losing your job, but you just say, you know what, I'm going to leave Florida, I'm going to go up to Atlanta because I think it's going to happen. What's it like to have that piece of history where you're such a central figure because you see pictures of the team at home plate and there's Hank Aaron being mobbed by his teammates and there's Craig Sager?
Yeah, like I said, I didn't know I was going to be on TV. I just knew I wanted to be there. And then when they do the ceremony, kind of like, you know, photographers tell me to get out of the way, so I stand next to Hank. And it's pretty amazing because, you know, today you'd be shot going out there. But it was the 70s. I probably had peanuts in one pocket of that trench coat, and I probably had a beer in the other. I was glad to be there.
Did you get a chance to ask Hank questions in all that madness?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. And, you know, same thing he said later, you know, oh, God, just thank God it's over, you know. And then everyone's congratulating him, so I have all those people, and I'm kind of eavesdropping on all his conversations. And he really didn't have many words to say. He was just getting mobbed every direction, and people holding on to him and grabbing him. And, you know, he wanted to know where the ceremony was going to be, and Tom House had come in and given him the ball. And but I had talked to him before the game, and, you know, since then, obviously, I've talked to him many times, and we've got a great relationship, and It's been fun, and I'm glad to see that, you know, he had a couple setbacks with his health this winter, but he's going to be there tonight, and obviously be honored as he well should be with what many think is still the home run that broke the record. You know, he ended up with 755, but many people still recognize him as the home run king because of the steroid era and all the other questions. So it's a good moment. I hope he enjoys it, and I hope they don't bring up too much of the negativity and all the stuff he had to go through, but just let him enjoy the moment as a baseball player and what an achievement he has on the record books as breaking one of the greatest records in our American pastime.
What does it mean to you to have that relationship with Hank that you have built over the years?
You know, it's amazing. It really is. And, you know, when Ted Turner decided to send us, the two of us, to Cuba on that goodwill mission without telling anybody because the U.S. government would let us go, Major League Baseball wouldn't allow us to go, and you know, we just went to Miami and then took a plane to Honduras and pretended we were going there. And we came up through the South and went all through Cuba, just the two of us, with no cameras, no media. Couldn't tell anybody we were there. And I got to really know him, you know, extremely well. And we got to be great friends. And, you know, I just, whenever I'm around him, you know, we just talk about it. And I had the same type of, I don't know, good fortune, I guess, as Ernie Banks. You know, because I idolized those two guys growing up, and then years later, I got to interview Ernie at CNN, and to find out that your idols growing up were as great of people as you thought you were as a kid, I mean, that's pretty special. And it's been a great relationship with both of them, and it is, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, not too many people get that opportunity. You know, you look like, you know, as great as LeBron is nowadays, you know, so many kids idolize LeBron, but how many are going to get a chance to meet him years from now, and hopefully they will find out that he's as great as they thought he was growing up. But a lot of times it's the other way around.
Besides the audio that, again, I thought great work in getting as much of it as you did. And what do you have in terms of mementos from that night? Is the audio what survives? Do you by chance have the wider khaki trench coat still?
Yeah, that was my dad's trench coat. We still have that. I have the tape recorder. Everybody got pins, or you could get pins that say 7:15. I got the notes from that night. They also had special balls ready, and so in case, you know, obviously going to the fans, whatever, they could, not like today where they're all, you know, hologrammed and everything, but they did have a little marking on it. So I got a couple of those with 7:15 on that Hank signed, and most of all, you know, I got the memories of that event. But I'm one of those that saved just about everything, so I could probably recreate the whole home run with a trench coat. I don't know if I can get my hair grow that long. I don't know if Turner would allow that, but we could probably do it again.
What stands out 40 years later? What are the immediate things that come to mind when you think about such an incredible moment in baseball history?
Just the access and the ability to do something like that when you go to the day of sporting events, all the security and all the wanding. They wouldn't even let me bring my tape recorder in nowadays. And obviously, if I stepped foot on a field, it was, you know, obviously something I'd probably get shot. Just the innocence back then. Yeah, I know Hank went through, you know, some death threats and all, but it was just a special time where baseball was the American pastime. And it was a record that was cherished for decades and one that he broke and well-deserved the honors and the accolades, and I'm glad we're still celebrating it today.
Thank you so much for sharing your memories of 7:15 and just such a special time in history.
Thank you very much. Anytime.
So Craig Sager, rest his soul, so great to catch up with me. That was a game day for him, as you heard. He was in Miami to cover the Heat game, but he was very generous with his time to talk about what was then the 40th anniversary of Hank Aaron's 715th home run, and today, Jimmy, the 46th anniversary.
Yeah, really good interview, and I remember when you did it 6 years ago, and really good stuff, so I certainly enjoyed hearing it, and what a great venture that was for Craig Sager.
What a roll of the dice, and it paid off big. We'll get a break when we return a final segment to today's edition of Sports Talk as you listen to 99.1, the Sports Animal.
The voices in our head may not be real, but they're loud and have some good ideas. This is 99.1, the Sports Animal.
Final segment to today's edition of Sports Talk. I'm John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams.
And before we hear more from Tamika Catchings, the Lady Vols have a commit from what looks like a grad transfer, Kian Green, 6'1 center out of Philadelphia. She plays for the Liberty Flames. She missed the 2018-19 season with an ankle injury. She was a Big South Player of the Year before that. John, that could be a really nice pickup for Kelly Harper.
Very much so, and as a couple announced they were leaving the Lady Vols, this is a big-time addition and somebody who's got experience and can plug right in and play.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's hear more now from Tamika Catchings. She was asked about where going into the Hall of Fame ranks among her career accolades.
I mean, I would have to say this is like the top. it's been so cool and so awesome, all the other things that have happened. happened. And, you know, I don't want to like discount all of that, because I think in different phases of life, and I mean, everybody always asks, oh, like when you look at the Olympics, which one's your favorite Olympics? And, you know, how do you compare one to the other? And I was like, you know, it's hard to do that because it's every 4 years. And every 4 years, Lord willing, you have an opportunity that your body stays, you know, like everything's tight and you can go out and nothing's hurt. And, you know, like that's a long time in between. So I think when you look at the Hall of Fame and you look at where it is, I mean, this is at the end of your career. There's no turning back. There's no, you know, hey, you know what? I thought about Fenner. I'm like, okay, if the Olympics is next year, that gives me more than 365 days to get myself together. Do I think that I, no, I do not. So take that off the table. But I mean, like, this is the end. And so I think when you look at just a storybook ending and you look at all the other things that you've accomplished along the way, like, this is just a great ending.
Catchings was also asked about how there wasn't really an arc to her career. She was just incredibly consistent. Catchings answers that question about her consistency.
Miss it? I don't miss my body hurting, Howard. I don't miss the cold tubs and the hot tubs. And I still do use the hot tub, just not the cold tub. But, you know, I think throughout my career, you know, one thing my father always told me is that every single year you have these young players that are coming out, and, you know, they want to take your job, and they're going to do whatever it takes. So he always stressed the importance of every year in the summer, figure out the things that you're going to work on, figure out what you're going to be better at, figure out what you're going to bring different, and build on the things that you have, but also, you know, get better in different areas. And so I think for me, it was a conscious effort of always coming in and bringing something different to my game. And I think the mental part, but even probably the biggest thing that I saw in myself is after the 2004 Olympics, being around, you know, Dawn Staley and just her impact and her leadership, that really affected me the most in changing my leadership style with our team. And then I think from there, just every year, continuing to get better.
Comments from Lady Vols Tamika Catchings, the first Lady Vol player to go into the Basketball Hall of Fame. John, just a little bit more on the Tennessee most recent commit from a grad transfer, Kian Green. We mentioned that in 2018-19, she missed the season. 2017-18, she was a Big South Player of the Year. She averaged 12.9 points. She ranked third in the league in offensive rebounding, and she was 11th in the nation. She made 61% of her field goal attempts. So, when you look at this addition, an inside player, I think you've got to be, you got to think she's going to come in and make an immediate impact.
Yeah, and you also look at perhaps adding to depth that Tennessee has, as you've got Tamari Key, who I think had a very good freshman year, and I think they're going to be formidable up front. Kentucky and Maryland were among the schools that were vying for her services.
Yeah, so good get for Tennessee.
It's a big-time get. It is. That's Jimmy Hyams. I'm John Wilkerson. Stay tuned. Up next, it's the Starting 11 on 99.1 The Sports Animal.